Why listen to the past when you can listen to the future? Welcome to the Think Future podcast, broadcasting from deep in the heart of Silicon Valley, California. We focus on innovation, startups, and the future, not necessarily those and not necessarily in that order. Here's your host.
How you doing, man? You look good. Look at you.
Yeah, well, feel good. Still at it. You know, this is like an addiction. You know, all my friends who've been retired for 10 years say, what in the world are you doing still working? And I said, yeah, I don't know what else to do.
You love it.
Yeah,
you love
it. Every so often I'll take, like 6 or 7 months off. And then, boy, I see something that I just have to grab hold of. And, that's what I do. That's what I do. You're looking awesome. Good yourself.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. But, things are going pretty well. Things are going pretty well. I haven't been able to sort of like semi-retire and then come back to things like you, which would be great for, but I'm looking forward to that.
Well, and then, you know, I keep promising my wife, no, this would be the last thing I do. she just rolls, you know, she doesn't even ask anymore. She just rolls her eyes.
That's one of the things when you have a creative mind, right? You're always thinking, "Oh, what can I can fix this, or I can do better at that." Like I can.
Yeah, well, can you know, I've been doing this stuff, Chris, for, since 1974, and you know, how do you stop?
You can't. You can't. Know, you're wired that way.
Well, it's. I tell people, you ever watch the Olympics on TV where they have the diver go up on that 10-meter platform, and you know, I went off my 10-meter platform a long time ago, and fortunately, I haven't hit the water yet. So.
And your form is beautiful, right? Your form is just beautiful coming down there.
Well, that depends. Sometimes you get cross currents from wind and cross currents from whatever else is out there, and boy, you can't control them. So you just got to readjust your posture, I guess.
Yeah, it's like riding a wave or what do you call it? Skydiving, right? When you're skydiving, you gotta like, it's like, well, you're
that may be even a better analogy than the Olympic platform,
because you're higher up and it hurts worse when you hit.
That's for sure, unless there's no water in the pool. So, anyway, awesome. Do you get the Hello Future and you do podcasts and,
I'm basically doing innovation consulting, futurist consulting, basically talking to companies about building new products and services and things like that. And, I've got this for all sorts of reasons. Basically, I had a podcast like way back in 2005, and that was just an audio podcast that I would record on my way to work. That went on for, for like 4 or 5 years or so. And then I got out of it for a while. Then I started doing video. That was more politically focused podcast. So this is more like, you know, innovation startups, like business focused podcasts. So
So I
do all sorts of interviews with all sorts of people. So, I mean, what I heard about you doing your thing, I thought, wow, that's really interesting, because that's an area that totally needs disruption. It needs to be like torn down and built it back from scratch. But I'm glad you're actually doing something on that front. So that's very cool.
Well, people ask me, where do these ideas come from? And I tell them, well, it's a combination. At first, you have to pay attention to things, and you begin seeing commonality, and you begin seeing connections in challenges, or one thing will cause another thing. And what happened to me with this is that, I'm not sure you're aware of it, but one of the investor groups that put money into UCI Web Group, which owned Online Focus, invested in what they did is they bought a for-profit university. Mm-hmm. Back in 2003, I think it was 2003. And they called me up and said, hey, we'd like to come talk to you. And I said, about what? And they said, oh, we're, you know, you've been involved with online things. And if you have to be a mean SOB, you're we like that in you. And we got a situation here. We bought this university and it's run by a bunch of academics. And it's always arguing, and always this problem or that problem. And we'd like to talk to you about it. I said, well, all right. So they came down to my office in Florida and said, what we'd like you to do is we'd like you to consider becoming president of Grantham University. Mm. And I said, well, boy, that's kind of hitting me out of left field.
Never thought of yourself as a university president, right?
Well, nobody else did either. This was a complete surprise. And I said, well, we have two problems here. One, I don't know the business of higher education. I can learn it. You know, it may take me 18 months or whatever, but that really isn't the defining factor in what I'm going to tell you. I said, but the defining factor is I have no interest in living in New Orleans. I don't like the place.
Right.
No offense to people who love New Orleans.
Great place to visit. Great place to visit.
Yeah. Yeah. And I said, so here we've got two major problems here. So I'm going to pass on the opportunity. And they said, well, you know, give it a little more thought. And I thought, you know, I thought, well, here, I like things that are logical. And I saw that despite the negative connotations of online education, which is being defended by University of Phoenix, and God bless them for being really the pioneer in that, it made sense to me. And what particularly made sense was the college and university administrators were bad-mouthing this. Mm. And I thought if they take enough time to badmouth something like this, which if they step back and looked at it objectively, they'd say, well, it's the natural progression of things.
Yep.
It's going to happen. And
oh, yeah, it's inevitable. The only question is when. When's it going to happen?
Well, in a fast forward, quite a bit. Anyway, I passed on that. And in May of 2005, I got a call from the same people. And they said, hey, we got a call from a fellow that controls the small university in Birmingham, Alabama. And he wants us to acquire because he's seen what we've done. And what they did is they really did a good job with Grantham without my help. Mm-hmm. And I said, where's it located? And they said, Birmingham, Alabama. I said, well, you know, I've never been to Birmingham, Alabama. What the heck? I'll fly up. You come down. And they were out of the D.C. area. And we'll have a conversation. Well, June of 2005, I engineered a board meeting with the people that controlled it. And at the end of the meeting, I was chairman and CEO of Andrew Jackson University.
Nice.
And it was more of a traditional school. They were doing some real backward things. So I put all the courses online with the help of Don Kastner and mm-hmm. Andy Millen, if you remember those names, Andy Millen from Kalamazoo.
Yep.
And January of 2006, we had everything online. We had a lot of faculty that objected to it, so I fired them.
Get with the program.
it was one of these things where I just had no patience with them.
Yeah.
And so ended up taking that school and began marketing, brought some capital in, a handful of million dollars, and it turned the thing around. It was in danger of failing. Well, while there, got involved with our students would complain because they did all their courses there on their computer. And they said, why do we have to go to these testing centers and spend $50 or $75, and we have to drive or this, and then we have to be there. And our response is, well, we have to have these rigorous programs because we're an accredited institution and
exactly.
blah, blah, blah. And we had to think about it. And so, well, they're right. Why can't we do that? And, but how can we do it? So cobbled together a little camera that's at the time stuck on top of the,
yep.
the laptop and decided that we were going to go and we were going to proctor exams for a certain group of our students. So all 4 or 5 months went by and we had 75-80% of our students doing all their exams and all their tests using what we cobbled together with identity verification and things like that.
Nice.
And we spoke at a conference and other schools came up and said, gee, we heard about what you're doing. We understand the students love it. Will you do it for us? And I said, no, this is our competitive advantage and forget about it.
Yeah.
After 5 or 6 schools came to us and said, you know, look, we'll pay you to do this for us. I said, well, that's market's telling me something here. So, so in the fall of October 15th, 2008, I still remember the date because it was against what the board wanted to do. I had a board of directors and what the administration wanted to do. I said, the hell with you. The right thing to do is to spin this off into a separate for-profit company. And we created a company called Proctor U, mm-hmm. which is became the 800-pound worldwide gorilla in online proctoring. Which
nice. Nice.
So I went ahead and transferred control in December of 2010 to the university. I said, gee, I'd rather be in the proctoring business where we have 2 competitors than be in the college business where we got thousands of competitors.
Exactly.
All of whom have a better, brand recognition than we do. They got a lot more capital. They got endowment funds. They got football teams. And so that's when I decided to take some time off. And then I looked at the marketplace and decided that there were a couple of things I wanted to do. Recognition. I happen to have a friend that ran Beatty Power and Associates. Mm-hmm. I was president. For like 20 years.
Wow.
So we decided that we're going to start a little thing called Best Value Colleges and look for little known, quality, reasonably priced colleges and universities that nobody ever heard of.
Mm.
So
that's a great idea.
Well, of course, the schools love it. I haven't figured out how to make money doing it yet.
But the schools aren't paying you for it, right? I mean, you're just doing your own surveys and figuring out.
We scour the internet, student comments. If they don't have 60 to 65% positive comments, they're out. We don't
right.
consider them. If they're too expensive, we don't consider them. If they've got problems, we don't consider them. So that got me involved with this stuff. So I was close to this education space. And I kept looking at statistics. For example, you got people that enroll in college, no matter what their age, a third of them drop out. Most yep. of those have debt, and that's not cool.
Mm-hmm.
It hurts them because they owe the money, and it hurts them because they have no degree.
Yeah.
And then I looked at those who did, especially in the last 3 or 4 years, graduated with a degree. 40% of those people, Chris, are in a job that doesn't require a degree.
Wow.
So they're amazing. Underemployed. And what tends to happen, and this is all, research that has been done by third parties that are credible. It's, it's not some thesis put together by some college student. These are think tanks.
Mm-hmm.
And what tends to happen is if somebody gets in a lower paying job, they're underemployed, this carries throughout, the next 5 or 10 years.
Yeah.
They just can't step up a little bit. So these things are rolling around in my mind and then the other stuff I'm looking at is the digital economy, how this transformation came in, and instead of it gradually happening over 20 years, it's happened over 4 or 5 or 6 years. And it seemed like it got critical mass a lot quicker. You know, people that were, and still are, some of them, the mainframe experts, mm-hmm. legacy systems, because companies have invested millions of dollars, you know, in the programming and in training their people, and they got these.
Oh, yeah. I mean, look at banks. Banks probably have iron that's been sitting around for 50 years that they still put layers on top of. I wouldn't that's be surprised.
Right. That's right. Well, you know, they've got the sunk investment, and, you know, they take a look at the budget and say, well, gee, what's it going to take? And not only if we switch, you've got all this disruption, and we know the system's going to be fouled up. You know, I don't Absolutely. Think anybody in the history of man has ever seen a system transition like that where everything worked 100% of the
Never
time.
Happens. No, never happens.
Yeah, never. So I'm looking at this stuff, and I thought, well, you know, there's going to be, you're going to have to go back a little bit and train some people who aren't going to go to college, maybe, and this is a phrase that's really a bad phrase, it's derogatory, not college material.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that
there was a time when most people weren't college material. It's just interesting how it's all completely changed. But you're absolutely right. There's people who just, and there's jobs that don't require it, right? It's just.
I mean, another thing we looked at, we said, well, if you got all these college grads, 40% of them in the last 3 or 4 years that are underemployed, where are the good jobs?
Yeah.
So where are the good jobs for people without degrees? And we said, gee, here you can, you know, average median income of, for example, someone who manages a steam facility to power, you know, power plants and things like this, you know, mm-hmm. they're making low six figures.
Yep.
There's no degree required there. And, you know, and there's, so we looked at a whole bunch of things like that. And while this was going on, last December, I think it was, I happened to watch a webcast. And I did it because I knew the fellow who was being interviewed, and his name is Ryan Craig. Ryan Craig is a venture capitalist and has been an entrepreneur. And I know the guy, so I wanted to watch it. Mm-hmm. And it was about a book he had just written, in fact.
A New You. I love it.
A New You. Faster and Cheaper Alternatives to College. I bought the book, and I read it, and I got two-thirds of the way through the book, and I saw that the last third was entirely made up of a directory of companies that provide coding boot camps and all these skill education programs. And I had tried to do something like that a couple of years ago, and it was so hard to find these organizations, I gave up. I
said, yeah.
Good idea, but too hard.
Yeah, plus probably just too early, more than anything, right? I mean, I think timing is like the most important thing, isn't it?
Well, timing helps. Sometimes you can be too early on something, and sometimes you can be too late on something. And that, you know, that's kind of like an entrepreneur's dilemma. You know, I could tell you stories about, you know, things that I got involved with, you know, before the internet was commercialized. And it was too early. You know, yeah. I had a company that I sold to a big publishing house, and it was online data. It was about the healthcare industry. And they decided to take this, instead of keeping it online and expanding it, they decided to turn it into a published hard copy product.
Wow.
And I
well,
said,
at the time, that probably made sense.
Well,
right?
the company was the one that published the physician's desk reference, the PDR. And they thought, well, it'll work for us here, it'll work for us there. And the thing ended up being a flop. So that was too early. Well, the timing was good, but I ended up selling it to the wrong company.
And
there's a whole story behind that. And that was not one of my smartest deals.
But we all make mistakes.
Oh boy. So, you know, and then timing sometimes works against us and sometimes it's favorable. So anyway, I read this book and I called Ryan Craig and I said, Ryan, this is good stuff. The timing is incredible. And no offense, but how many people are going to buy this book? Mm-hmm. This is the kind of information that needs to be available to the mass. The public should see this. Mothers and fathers should see this. He's got a high school kid. They're thinking about college. And the kid may say, well, you know, gee, I don't know. I don't think I want to go. And the parents say, oh, my God. How can that happen? And
I know. It's the worst possible thing, right?
You have to go to college, you know. So, you know, it's just ingrained into people's minds. And so I told him, I said, this belongs online. And I want to do it. And Ryan Craig said, okay, go for it.
Nice.
So I got some of my programmers and designers, and we cobbled together a website, and it was kind of a website that, and you know, you came out of the web design business and what have you. If you can picture a website that maybe I go on GoDaddy and design myself, I mean, you talk about minimum viable product. This
right.
was it. I'm not going to win any design war awards. But I didn't want to spend too much money or too much time if this was not of interest to the marketplace.
Yeah, absolutely.
So on May the 14th this year, we unveiled the site. We got a little publicity, and it hit the fan. Mm-hmm. And so as I did with that proctoring company, the market told me that what we thought was good timing and good stuff. The market said, yeah, we agree with you. So I decided to spend a little more money and spend a little more time and upgrade the site. When we first put it up, we had about 160 thereabout organizations that had boot camps and coding schools and things like that, that had 1,400 different courses. Mm-hmm. And when I decided to go ahead and step this up a little bit, we now have, I think it's 2,300 organizations that collectively a little over 20,000 courses. Mm. And a lot of these, And a big surprise to them, a lot of these certificate courses are offered by traditional colleges and universities. It's just they're not emphasized. I mean, the admissions people aren't even aware that they're there.
You know, really?
Yeah. It's crazy. It's crazy. But you know, I'll give you an example. One of my people spoke at a conference in Chicago today, and it was about the stuff that we're doing. And the audience was made up of traditional colleges and universities. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and they said, the response was, well, gee, who's doing all this stuff? In other words, who's providing the courses? And my guy said, you are. You are. Come on. Wake up.
They didn't even realize it. That's hilarious.
You know, look at the programs you're offering. And, you know, so it's indicative of the fact that here you have this big movement. You know, it's like a tidal wave. The tidal wave is made up of ones and zeros and everything. I mean, you think about what you and I've seen. All of a sudden, you know, we had servers and we had databases. And then somebody came around with a concept called a cloud. Mm-hmm. And you know, what's next? I mean, and this thing began moving quickly. And you take a look at hiring. You look at reports done by, and there's something I put on my whiteboard there. July of 2019, the Lumina Foundation. This is, and I'll quote there. It says, workers in virtually all industries, including the service sector, need technical savvy to succeed on the job.
Absolutely.
And it's like, even people that I hire, because I'm not a technical guy. I couldn't even do that minimum viable product website. But
it took off, right? I mean, you got people going to it. You got people checking it out.
Yeah, so well, really what happened was the phone started to ring. The texts came in. The emails came in. And, people that were thinking about this contacted us and said, how can we participate? We get calls from finance companies that finance courses in coding and, skill-based schools. I didn't even know that they existed until the call came in. One's called Skills Fund, another one's called is Climb Financial. I mean, I'd never heard of these companies.
So these are basically trade schools, right? Aren't they? I mean, that's kind of like the old school version of it. Would you call them trade schools or?
They don't like that term because that pigeonholes them into something, a picture. Are they trade schools? Well, let me tell you what the characteristics are. With a trade school, you tend to spend a couple of years learning a trade. These are what I'll call short courses. Short courses defined as 13 weeks or 3 months or 6 months. The longest that's in this group is really a year long. Mm. And what you do is you come up with a credential. I mean, if it's a coding boot camp and you learn how to code, that's a 13-week course, and you get the certificate that says, "Hey, I'm a coder.
Right.
I can write this code, or I could do this or do that." And it steps up from there. And I'm saying, coding, I would say would kind of be like the floor competency. And it goes up to where you got, security, data security, and things like that. And what tends to happen when I talk to these schools, a lot of their students already have a college degree. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And they find that if they're not savvy in a digital way, they're either because they can't do it themselves or they don't understand what the people that work for them are doing, which is kind of my dilemma and probably always has been for decades. So there's this where you would think that this is the 18-year-old kid that doesn't want to go to college or they can't afford to go to college or nobody in the family's ever going to college. They go to a trade school. That's not it. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal the 28th of October, and it talked about this big company that I can't remember the name of it, but they've got like 40,000 employees, and 1,400 of them are people that work on the mainframes that they still use, but they're going through this transition, and they're going through it slowly.
Right.
And the mainframe folks had a choice, and the choice was, and a lot of these are older in their 60s, their choice was continue doing what you're doing and eventually, you're going to retire, whether you like it or not, or you can learn new skills on our dime. But you got to continue in your job, you got to perform, but you've also got to learn these new skills.
Right.
And these are what I'll define as digital skills. So that encompasses.
So do you think that these are, like you said, most of these students already have a degree and this is just an add-on? That's the best way to do it? Or are people just taking these and actually getting decent jobs out of them?
Well, here's what I see happening. And the other thing is that I spend probably 5 hours a week in looking for statistics as to what's transpiring. And if I see what's transpiring, then I ask, why is it transpiring? and I can't find statistics. Mm. But what I see happening, and I might be wrong, but what I see happening is I see that people who are interested in not taking 4 years to go to college, or actually it ends up being 6 years in most instances.
Absolutely. That's what happened to my oldest, and my youngest is just about to start, or he's 2 years in, and it's definitely going to take longer, but go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, they take a look at what's out there. They see all this negative publicity or media coverage about how expensive college is. They read some of the same stuff that I look at and I'm shocked by, that, you know, the 40% the degree holders that are underemployed, but they still got $30,000 to $100,000 in debt because of their loans. So what's the right thing to do? Some kids and some parents, going to a traditional college or university is a must. It's a must because it makes them feel good, doesn't embarrass them when they're talking to their neighbors or their relatives.
Well, it depends on the profession too, right? I mean, if you're going to be a doctor or a lawyer or something like that, then you need to be certified and go through a certain amount of education. Yeah. But if you're not interested, if you just want to be a coder, I mean, I read the other day, 75% of coders are self-taught, right? Yeah. So if you're going to be a coder, it's most likely that you're going to be self-taught. You'll have some university, but you may not.
You know, Chris, it's interesting that you brought that up. We're in the research and development park at Florida Atlantic University, which is a state university here. And I don't know, they got 40,000 students or whatever. And they have a computer science department. So we interview people that are computer science graduates from what's colloquially called FAU here. And when I first started doing this, I made the mistake of hiring these people. Mm-hmm. And to find out that they really didn't know what they were doing, what they learned in school was as much theory and stuff that happened years ago, because that's what the instructor knows, you know, C++ or
yeah.
Excuse me, what's that? Is that your grade? Oh, no, that's what I know. You know, I mean, it's just, so I stopped hiring. In fact, I even brought a guy in here with a PhD in computer science. Now, wow. He was great at going to the whiteboard and saying, well, this and this and this. And I got a little frustrated because we were paying him a lot of money. And I said, Thomas, look, I'm going to give you a specific assignment. And we're going to put a timeline on it. And he couldn't do it. He couldn't actually do something.
Wow.
He could talk about it. And he could theorize about it. So I fired him. I mean, I was so disappointed. The last two people that we hired are self-taught. Mm. And the interview with the last one we hired, I don't know. As you might guess, we get an awful lot of, you put a job request. I use Indeed. They're, in my opinion, the best place to go.
Yeah.
You get an awful lot of applicants. And the four people that were finalists for the job were all self-taught. Hmm.
Did they have college degrees as well, or did they go to one of these?
Two did. Mm-hmm. Two did, but the college degrees had nothing to do with coding. It just, you know, it kind of supports what we see in these statistics. So what's the right answer? It depends on the person. And notice I didn't say kid or high school student, because we get all kinds of people that if you go into one of these. Excuse me, coding schools, and you look at the people there beavering away at their machines, and I would say I didn't see anybody that looked like they were teenagers. Mm-hmm.
But my son went to a coding school. Actually, he wanted to get into software development. So, and he also didn't want to spend a lot of time going to university or money paying for university. So he went to a coding boot camp. It was a 12-week program. It's actually a live-in. So he he slept, breathed, ate code. Like, it was almost like a boarding school. It was great. And he grew up a lot out of it, and he came out with, and he went straight into a job at a cloud company. So, I mean, it can be done. But see, the thing is that it's still, like you were saying earlier about Phoenix, it's still kind of like an outsider fringe thing, right? I mean, do we have, like, what do you think has to happen for these companies to realize that, you know, you've got some really good people here? Just because they don't have a college degree doesn't mean they don't know their stuff and can do what you want.
Well, one of the things that I'm beginning to see, I have no personal experience with it, but I say see, that's the media and things that are my inputs. I'm beginning to see companies going and outsourcing what I'll call training organizations. It could be boot camps. Mm-hmm. Or like this big company that the Wall Street Journal did a story on, to come in and to, for those employees that are willing to learn something and to, improve their lot in the company and, their future and make it a little more secure, will bring in companies to train their employees. The other thing I'm seeing is companies, entrepreneurial companies that provide this type of training, now emphasizing, instead of going to the general public and say, here, come sign up and go to my computer coding ashram.
It's not a bad idea. That's not a bad name, actually. Especially out here, they would love that. People would love that.
Yeah. I got talking. Somebody said Est. I said Est. Are you talking about up the northern coast of California, up there in Big Sur? They said, "What? What's that? What are you talking about?" I said, "Oh, that's old time stuff. Sorry." but the companies are now making a conscious effort not to go to the general public, but to go to companies, decent sized companies, because the people that run those companies are seeing the same thing that I'm seeing and the same thing that you're seeing, and they read the Wall Street Journal and they see some stuff like what we're doing with alternatives to college, and they're thinking about it, and I'm sure they've had the same experience in hiring. If they pay attention to their HR department numbers, is if you bring somebody in that supposedly has a degree in computer science and they can't do anything, where do you find people that can do something that what you need? The other thing that's happening, and I think it's great, is that notable companies, high-profile companies are beginning to say, we don't automatically require a college degree to hire people. And out your neck of the woods, that's happening a lot.
Oh, yeah. I think Google used to have that rule, and then they eliminated it something like 5 years ago because you just need degree or relevant experience. And I'm like, oh, great. Now I can get a job at Google now. If I wanted to go.
So people are beginning to take the blinders off and say, well, how do we get a valuable employee, or how do we make an employee valuable? And it's not this cookie cutter idea that's been propagated by admission counselors at traditional colleges and universities because they don't know any better. It's all they've learned.
So what kind of is there a system to determine the quality of what you're going to get, what the quality of the education? I mean, how do you determine that, college X or college Y or college, B are good? I mean, is that just comes from, where does that come from?
Are you talking about colleges? Are you talking about coding schools?
Oh, sorry, the coding schools. I'm not talking about the colleges. I'm talking about the people who are on your, the companies that are on your website that do the training.
We're all wondering. In fact, it's interesting that you asked that question because of this other stuff that we did, Best Value Colleges. We know that there's a need for something like that in this industry. So, and all this stuff is like happening now. I have a call tomorrow at 1:30 with an organization that was put together by a bunch of coding schools, for the lack of a really more universal terminology for what these companies do. And the organization is, its purpose is to determine quality in coding schools. Now, how do you do that? I'm very interested in talking to them because, you know, what we look for in quality for the colleges and universities, for the best value schools, we look for quality as determined by students and graduates, not by some phony U.S. news propaganda, which is the biggest scam in the world. So we don't know yet. We don't know yet. But the good thing is people are thinking about it and talking about it. I mean,
it's definitely
came I think to you when you said, well, okay, you got all these things. Where are the good ones?
Exactly. I mean, and I think that's what's happening with what you were saying before, is that it'll probably end up being some kind of crowdsourced thing, right? Well, you'll go to the graduates and you'll go to people who've been through the school and go, okay, you know, X number of people who went through coding school X, 80% got a job out of this one, 20% got a job out of this one. And I don't know, getting a job might not be the only criteria. There's probably other criteria. But well, I'm saying that's probably your number one reason why you'd go to a coding school is to get a decent
I mean, if I had a magic wand that I could wave, and if I could get information from employers who hire these people, you know, that's the rabbit in the magic hat.
Yeah.
But how do you do that? Well, nobody knows yet.
Right. And now, then what about, so do you think there's like, it's still a prejudice for people who've been to, been to college to hire college graduates?
Well, I can speak for myself, and I'm a lot more leery. I'm a lot more critical because you have a degree, and I don't care what the degree is. It could be a PhD. Mm-hmm. You know, plus the fact that I've been in the business of colleges and universities, actually run a university.
Right.
So I look at things, a little differently, and I am not your average employer, and I'm not your average person when it comes to that, because I'm skeptical. There are when I was the CEO of that small university, one of the things that I noticed is that you get some people that maybe weren't communicative. There were no personal skills, but they were really good at certain things. And, you know, one of the things that I tried to encourage the instructors is to overlook some of these personality traits that might be distasteful to some people, mm-hmm. and might not help them stay in a job if they got one. But look at the competency in that particular, whether it's a technology or whether it has to do with dealing with law enforcement, things like that, or business for that matter, business finance in particular, where you don't have to have a great personality.
Right.
You have to
It helps if you don't, actually, right?
Well, no comment. You don't so, but what I see is I see these big changes coming, but gradually, and it's mindset. It's boy, you know, those coding schools are great, but for somebody else's kid, not mine.
Yeah. Yeah. But that, look, but what you're saying is that a college degree doesn't necessarily guarantee you anything more any nowadays, right? Because there used to there was a window of time when having a college degree was a real plus, and now we've kind of passed that window. But depending on your role, obviously, but
yeah. I think people who look at the situation objectively, and aren't swayed by the way things were 20 years ago, you can't help but come to that conclusion.
Yep.
I mean, it's, you know, I've heard the phrase, bachelor's degrees are a dime a dozen now. Everybody has one. And the only differentiator is if you have a master's degree. You know, and
eventually PhDs will be the only differentiators. Then you're going to be like, people are going to be in school for like, what, 20 years before they get into anything?
Well, the problem there is to get a PhD, unless it's somebody who goes back to college, they're sequestered in an environment that is not conducive to really operating in the real world.
Exactly. Exactly.
I've hired PhDs and I fired PhDs. I don't want to sound like I've had 1,000 PhDs working for me. That's not what I do. But the ones that I have had working for me, you know, I just have to scratch my head and shrug my shoulders and say, gee, they better go back to teaching a school, because out here in the real world, unless you're a scientist.
Yeah.
And then of course you're probably not in the real world anyway.
That's right. It's a small community of people who need to be at that level.
You know, and they're focused, and as they should be. And that's really that, you know, their specialty is what's on their mind most of the time. So
I got it. Where do you see education going next? So right now we've moved from colleges and 4-year degrees, 6-year degrees, whatever, to sort of coding boot camps and other boot camps where you have like short-term training courses that take you into work. What do you think is going to happen after that?
Well, what I hear people that are smarter than me say is that your segregated lengths of time spent learning something like grade school and high school and college are going to turn into a lifelong experience, to where as technology changes and where business demands change, it'll be an ongoing thing rather than, well, okay, I put my 4 or 5 or 6 years in college, I got a degree and life is wonderful. You're going to have to change with the times, and I think that employers will begin demanding that. You know, so I spent some time in Detroit, Michigan, over the past 2 months, and I go back there because that's where I was born in Detroit, and I have family there, and I broke my heart to see what happened to the city. But I see this where everything before centered around the automobile industry, whether it was banking or whether it was supply or finance or you know, whatever, they have begun to expand what it is that they do there in the Detroit area. And a lot of it, and this is what really brought me back, a lot of it has to do with teaching people technology. And you know, they have with the state university there in the city, it's called Wayne State University. They've collaborated with a couple other organizations and they've created what's called Tech Town. And the idea there is to help people who want to be entrepreneurs or want to learn coding or want to learn something technically oriented. They've got the support groups, and they've even got, you know, the funding, grants from the state, and they got the seed venture capital funds, which is all new there. And, and that's not the only city that's doing this. They're realizing that you have to expand, and the focus now is on the digital end of things. But you also hear a lot of complaints about industry, the people coming out of college or people coming out of high school, because they spend all their time and, one of these things and exercising their thumbs. They don't have any interpersonal skills.
Yeah.
So the thinking is that not only should you be able to move your thumbs fast, but you should be able to put the device down and interact with human beings.
Yeah. And no one's teaching that. They should be teaching it.
Not many are teaching that. One of the things that always surprised me, and I changed it a little bit when I got control of that university, is that I thought that one of the most important things people can learn is psychology. Why do people think the way that they do? And how is this interaction? How do you take advantage? And I don't mean that in a negative fashion, but how do you take advantage of listening skills? And then how do you take advantage of understanding why somebody does something or says something or insists on something? One of the things that I've always tried to import in people that were important in companies that I ran is, you got to look at the psychology, the situation. Why is this happening? What are the factors in here? What are the dynamics? How do you interpret them? You don't interpret them because your grandfather said that, everybody from Georgia is a peckerwood. That's an extreme thing, and it probably offends a lot of people, but sorry. there's going to have to be more emphasis on that because it's got to neutralize, some of this stuff.
Well, if more education is going that way, then how do we push back to the working on the interpersonal stuff and on the psychology? Do we have to force people back in? Like, we've gone so far now towards remote learning. Do we have to start pushing people back into classrooms and circles where they actually have to meet and interact with other people face to face?
Well, there's a lot to be said for that. It doesn't necessarily have to be a classroom. It can be a boot camp ashram.
Yeah.
That's
right. It could be just like a circle where we're all sitting, talking to each other. But isn't that, if you look at way, way back at education, during ancient Greece, wasn't it just like Socrates, standing under a tree and people talking to each other? And they were discussing.
Yeah.
And so my oldest son was saying the same thing. It's like education has gone from being a thing where there was a lot of discussion. There was the teacher was talking, there was a lot of discussion from just the teacher dumping facts into your brain. And maybe it's better to dump the facts into your brain remotely and then also add on the discussion piece so that, that you have an interaction with people. So it's a combination of offline and online methods is actually the most effective way to learn.
Well, the facts are the facts. Math is math.
Yeah.
Science, although some will dispute it, is pretty much a cut and dried thing. But what's not cut and dried are the nuances of humanity. And when you plug this into the challenge that business is, how do you deal with that? I don't think that you're ever going to see somebody as the CEO of a large company that has no people skills.
Yeah.
The other thing too is that I hate it when groups of people are categorized and labeled.
Yeah.
Because when you look at it, these are all individuals.
Exactly.
And they have their issues and they have their strengths and what have you. And what I look for is in thinking of the mass as a bunch of individuals, or thinking of that one individual, I think that an individual has to be reached through messaging, and messaging is, there's a world of messaging, and you're messaged constantly. Different media and friends of yours and family, you get all these messages, and the message has to begin to turn us that these skills are really important. Mm-hmm. Now, some individuals could be like this wall, they don't get it.
Yeah.
Or they don't care.
Yeah.
But there are, or there will be, and there are individuals who can pick this up, and they perceive what the issues are, what the challenges are, what the value is. And if they're the least bit curious, I mean, these are the ones that need to lead the way.
Yeah.
I mean, when we grew up, there was always the kid in the neighborhood that was kind of like the leader. Either when you're real young, it was because he was bigger and stronger. When you got a little older, because he was cooler or smarter.
Yeah.
In my neighborhood, there were, say, 7 or 8 kids within, the same age group that I was in. And, when I experienced this, there were the shy kids, the outgoing kids, you could never shut them up. But then there were the kids that kind of emerged as leaders.
Yeah.
So I think that people are good. People are curious. These prejudices, and I don't mean racial, the prejudices to what's important and what's not important, some people are going to pick it up, and others, they're just going to say, don't tell me. I don't want to see it.
But like you said, I mean, it's the same with hiring practices, right? I mean, people are going to hire people based on their individual fit within the team, right? So if they're okay with somebody who's not very communicative, or they just want to shove them in a cubicle and have them code all day long, they might be okay with that because they just talk to them over Slack and they never have they don't need the personal connection with them. But I think
talk about hiring people for a second here. One of the things that I've learned, and as you're probably aware, I've run a lot of companies and I've hired a lot of people. I don't care. I mean, I've tried psychological tests. I've tried this. I've tried that. Hiring is a guessing game. Mm-hmm. And you have to realize that the odds that you're going to be wrong and hiring the wrong person or the person for the wrong reason is going to be about 50-50.
Wow. That high, huh?
And yeah, it is, unfortunately. Now, bigger companies, it might be different, but I've never run a really big company. And what I've learned is that you make your best guess and you give it in my instance, I say 3 to 4 months. Mm-hmm. If the hiring decision was wrong, you'll for sure, if you're paying attention, for sure find out in maybe 3 months, but 4 months at the outside. And you can't fix. There's no right way to do the wrong thing with somebody that has turned out not to be who you thought she was.
Yeah.
Or who you thought he was.
Yeah. No, I agree with that 100%. In fact, I'm thinking that we should just trash almost the entire system and then just go to some kind of apprenticeship model where, you have one interview, you see what your gut feel reaction is, and then you hire them. And then if it doesn't work out within a certain period of time, let them go. Because I think you're right. I mean, you're never going to find if you look at the typical talent acquisition process today, you're never going to really know what this person's going to be like on the job doing the specific work, because you're creating all these artificial situations that don't exist in real life. Because once they get past the interview and all these other things, it's like, okay, this person is maybe totally different. Maybe they may interview really great, but they suck, right? So
We've had some of those. You
know? Yeah.
We've had some of those. I think one or two ran online focus for a while.
Well, that's the thing, right? I mean, I think we should be moving more towards that model where you just say, okay, this guy, you know, instead of interviewing like 1,000 people, you know, interview a couple people, see if one person feels right, and then bring them on for a little bit, see how they perform. Why not? I mean, is there a reason why we can't do that? I mean, it just seems to me.
Of course not. See, here's, you know.
It's like, I almost think there's like some legal reason. Like if you hire somebody, you got to keep them on for a certain amount of time but it's not like that, right? I mean, if you're in a state that's like whatever state, like California is one of those states, right?
Right.
Anybody can say, hey, you're out of here.
Yeah, right to work. You got no.
Yeah, like that's the phrase I was looking for, the right to work state. Yeah, so I can bring you in for like 5 days, and if it doesn't work out after a week, you know, you're out or whatever. I can give you longer. But the whole crucible of the resume and the interview and all that junk just seems like the wrong, it's like you're getting the wrong thing out of it because you just really need to know how this guy or gal is on the job, how they do their work, right?
No, you're absolutely right. I'm thinking back in the first company I ever owned. I had a guy that was a bad apple. Mm. And he had his son in the hospital, so I felt sorry for him. And I kept him on, and I kept him on. And he was his own worst enemy. He just interacted with people in a very negative manner. And what was bad about it is he dealt with customers.
Right.
You know, so it's one problem after another. So, and his first name was Bob. And I said, look, you know, I know that, and I can't remember his son's name. So-and-so's still in the hospital and you get a lot of pressure and everything else. But I'm beginning to look like a fool keeping you on. And I don't like that. And, you know, and this is just a bad thing. So this is really going to be your last warning. Mm. And about 3 weeks later, something happened. And he walked into my office and said, I know. You're going to fire me. And I said, yeah, you're right. And I felt so guilty about doing that. And then I thought, you know, later on, everybody said, oh, boy, you finally got rid of Bob. And then I said to myself, if I can fire Bob with the kid in the hospital, I can fire anybody.
Yep.
And I just got to separate myself from this. And that was back in the 70s. So.
Yeah, but if you think about it, I mean, that was the best thing for the team. Right. It was the best thing for the team. It was the best thing for the company. And it was probably the best thing for him because maybe he found another role afterwards that was more suited to what he was like.
Well, he shouldn't have been dealing with the public because he would take a complaint or something like that personally. And he'd just fly off the handle.
Yeah.
And, you know, and that was.
Well, we're really over time, so I just want to wrap things up. So how do we people get in touch with you if they want to get in touch with you? What's the best way?
With me personally?
Well, no, with your company. I mean, do you want to give off your website?
Take a look at the website. The name of the company is Alternatives to College. Mm-hmm. And the site is, no genius here, alternativetocollege.com.
And as soon you'll be putting in some kind of a rating or review system or something so that people can say, oh, this college A or college B, or do you already have something like that on there?
No. Okay. In fact, what we did is we sent out emails to, I don't remember how many, and we said, give us some feedback on this because we're going to begin looking at organizations like yours to give them a best value award.
Nice.
So we're starting that. And then my conversation tomorrow with this organization who's trying to do it from probably coming at it from a different direction. I'm talking to two companies that finance these education programs, and they're interested in finding out how to find out what the quality programs are. But if I could, I'd get that one, then I'd go to employers, who's had employees that have passed that first 3 or 4 month window.
Yeah.
And said, you know, where are the good schools and where are the bad schools? So it's coming. It's coming. A lot of work. It's not easy, but why not do it?
All right. Well, it has to happen. So thank you so much. This was great. So you should go to Workday. Have you thought about going to Workday or one of those other sort of giant HR companies that do all the management? Because they might have the data that you're looking for.
No, we haven't thought about that. But you know what I'm doing is I'm reaching out for somebody else who is already thinking along the same lines.
Oh, okay.
You know, and say, well, what are you doing? Here's what we're doing. Let's collaborate on this. Let's not have, a dozen different rating services.
Oh, no. Yeah, you need one. But I'm just saying that, you know, where do you get the hiring data, right? So you know that, you know, this person was hired by that company.
Well,
right?
the attempts that have been made through the schools.
Right.
And that's kind of like the U.S. Department of Education wants hiring data from college regarding college graduates.
Yeah.
Now, how much of that is accurate? Well, I'm not spending a lot of money on that.
Well, yeah, because it, you know, it's in their best interest to make it look good, right? I mean, you want an independent source.
Yeah. And you know, one thing that you learn is that these colleges, so they don't look bad or to gain prestige, will do some pretty absurd things.
Mm.
Pretty absurd.
Not surprising.
And well, look at the, you know, this admission scandal. That's
Yeah, exactly. That's a perfect example.
I mean, you got to find somebody complicit within the college or university to make this happen.
Exactly.
And why do they do it? Well, a lot of times it's money. Sometimes it's prestige. I don't know.
The human ego.
Yeah. Well, it's like coding school. What do you mean? My kid's got to go to Georgetown.
That's right.
Or Southern Cal. Or.
But you find that a lot of people who come out of university are completely unprepared for the work world.
Oh, absolutely. Right?
Even if they do like a decent degree, like engineering or something like that, everything they know, they get this high level. They're in this cloud level, and they're not coding. They're not in the depths of what needs to be done tomorrow.
I'll give you one more example. I look over there because you sat over there. I heard what was apparently to me anyway a bright kid just graduated. Articulate, everything else, and he had a specific job, but for some reason he kept getting sidetracked. A lot of it, and he was bold enough to spend a lot of time on Facebook, right in front of me.
Mm-hmm.
And
wow,
and you know, and I say, well, gee, you got to pay attention to this. Pay attention to this. You got to do this. This is what we want you to do. And when have it done by Friday or whatever the case might be. Finally, I said, look, this is not working out. You got to grow up. You got to learn the way this stuff works. So I'm gonna let you go. This is your last day. And Chris, and this is not an exaggeration, he sat in the chair there across the room with his head down and wouldn't leave.
You're kidding me.
Wouldn't leave.
Wow.
So
crazy.
In a way, I felt sorry for him. Because here's somebody just, you know, punched him in the nose. And finally I said, look, I said, you're not a bad guy. You're smart, you're articulate. But you got to learn that there are certain demands if someone's going to pay you.
Yeah.
There's certain demands that you got to give me value because it's my money I'm paying you.
Exactly. Exactly right. They have to understand the formula.
So, but, you know, I walked out, went across the hall, and I said, to one of the girls that worked for us, you got to come in here and help me get him out of the, away from the desk over there. I said, you know, I don't want to get an assault and battery.
No. And you didn't have like a security you could call to say, can you escort this guy out of the building?
No. know, I try to do it the gentle way, but I mean, you know, that's the extreme.
Yeah. Yeah.
And unfortunately I experienced it. That's
all right. Yeah. Chris, all right. Well, thank you, sir. This was great.
Welcome. It's good to reconnect.
Yeah. Good to see you again, man. You're looking, what is your secret of life, man? You're looking so healthy and young.
Oh,
it's like, what do you do? What are you doing? Like, what are you eating? What are you exercising or something?
I drink good wine and I watch what I eat. And I exercise, mm-hmm. and I exercise my brain as much as I do my body. And
well, you have to.
One of the things, you know, about being an entrepreneur. Somebody sent me an email today and said, we're doing a survey. We want to know what kind of like hours that you work as an entrepreneur. And I said, hours that I work. I said, I'm constantly thinking about the business.
Yep.
I mean, my I'll be having dinner with my wife and she'll say, Hello. What are you thinking about now?
Same thing happens to me. Exact same thing.
Yeah.
And then I like formulate a new business and I'm pitching it to her and she goes, oh, not another one.
Oh boy. Well, I'll tell you what, there's hardly a greater level of satisfaction in life than doing the creative stuff. And I don't mean artsy. I mean, you know, taking this and putting it together with that and having an acquaintance write a book that sparks an idea. Let's run with it. All of a sudden, by the way, we introduced it May the 14th. And we got the response that I was hoping for, but you're never sure. Mm-hmm. 2 weeks later, I'd formed a company, and here we are.
Nice. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you, sir.